Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF and following up on a podcast on mushingradio.com. For the last several months, we've been talking to a lot of the Iditarod veterans here on Mushing Radio. We've had a lot of great conversations with those guys, but tonight we have a very special guest. She is probably the one lady here in Alaska that has her finger on the pulse of mushing. Her name is Helen Hegener, calling in from right here in Alaska. Helen, how's it going?
Hello, Robert. It's going great this evening.
Thank you very much for joining us. I'm looking very forward to talking to you this evening about some mushing history. As you and I talked before the show started, you know, we've covered a lot of interviews over the last few months from some really big names in the sport of mushing, especially in the Iditarod world, but there's a heck of a lot more to mushing than the Iditarod, isn't there?
That's true. There certainly is.
So, I know you are a huge history buff. I know you do this for a living with Northern Light Media. So let's jump right into this. Before we do, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Boy, I've been in Alaska off and on since 1965. I came up with my parents when I was just a teenager. Alaska's home. I've been here forever. And I was involved with the beginnings of the Iditarod in just a small way. I went to some of the organizational meetings and, you know, helped with a little bit of fundraising and sat in on some of the, like, the rules when they were trying to decide what the mushers should take to Nome. I was, you know, part of the conversation. And years later, when I got back, you know, I moved outside, had kids, you know, spent about 20 years outside of Alaska. And then when I moved home and got back into the Iditarod, the history of it really struck me. It was like, oh, my gosh, I was here for the beginning of this, and I wasn't finding a lot about the history. It was all on the, whatever the present-day race was. So I started digging into the history and talking to more and more people who remembered it, who remembered the beginnings of the race. And the more I found, the more interesting it became. I mean, there's just, it's a fascinating gold mine for a history buff, all of these mushers who were, you know, setting records and, you know, doing this incredible race to Nome for one, but there were also so many other races that were, you know, really just amazing. So the more I dug, you know, and I'm still digging, the more I learn, the more I find there is to the history of mushing. It's really fascinating, very, very colorful. There were some real characters involved, and some just absolutely amazing dogs. I mean, the dogs are just incredible.
They are, and I remember a couple of years ago, I guess it'll be 2 years September, you helped put on a mushing history conference at the Winter Sports Symposium up in Willow, and I'm sure that piqued a lot of interest. You had some great guests talk about, you know, some of the early days. I remember, I believe that was when Mary Shields was in town, was it not?
Yes, that was. You're right, Robert. That was actually our second mushing history conference. The first one was the year before when Tim White, I'm sure you know that name,
mm-hmm.
Tim got a hold of me and said that he was interested in putting together a mushing history conference and could I be his coordinator in Alaska for it. So Tim and I worked together for several months. We got it to come together. We had some amazing speakers. Joey Reddington, Joe's son, came down. He had brought an amazing slideshow of the Reddington family archives with him. We had, you know, just an amazing lineup of people. You know, we held that at the university. It was actually a 2-day event. We held the first part of it at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and the second part out in Wasilla. And, you know, then it was so successful that the next year we followed up with the one that you attended in Willow.
You know, Helen, I definitely want to delve into some of these stories that you've heard over the years and research. But, you know, up here in Alaska, I've only been here a couple of years now. It's been a dream to come up here and train for that crazy Iditarod race and the whole nine yards. But, you know, mushing is still a part of the culture to a lot of things. You see it everywhere throughout town. Even at our local McDonald's, there's a dog sled as an ornament. How do you think, not only did Alaska shape the history of mushing, because there was a lot of mushing outside of Alaska, especially on the East Coast, New Hampshire, and things with the Lombards and that sort of thing. But my first question to you is, and of course it's obvious, but how do you think Alaska has shaped the sport it is today?
Boy, that's a very good question, Robert. Like you say, there was a lot of mushing going on back in the back on the East Coast in particular, back in the 20s and 30s. It was a very popular pastime. And, of course, you know, the mushing, you know, was the mode of transportation here in Alaska since around the turn of the century. The gold rushes, you know, they needed the huskies to move the freight and move the goods and move the people to and from the gold mining operations during the gold rushes. And not only the Klondike Gold Rush, but the Nome Gold Rush, the Fairbanks Gold Rush, and a lot of smaller ones also, like Iditarod. And wherever there were mushers and their dog teams, of course, you know, when the work is done, their pastime was to see who's got the fastest team. So they started racing them, you know, just for fun. And in, I believe it was 1908, Scotty Allen and a few other guys up in Nome decided that, you know, we should just have a real race, have a purse, make this a, you know, and the only precedent they had for that was the horse races in Kentucky. So they patterned what was the first organized sled dog race was the All-Alaska Sweepstakes. They patterned it after the horse races in Kentucky. And a lot of the terms that are still used in sled dog races, like leaderboard, you know, those terms and a lot of the way the race was held, a lot of the rules came directly down from horse racing. So the first sweepstakes race was in 1908. That was won by a guy named John Hegness. The next year, Scotty Allen won it, and I believe he won it the year following. Leonard Sepulow was another one who won, you know, three of the sweepstakes races and became one of the greatest mushers. And, you know, I think it was, that was kind of the beginnings of how Alaska shaped the sport of dog mushing. And Leonard Sepulow took his dogs outside after the Sarum Run, but, you know, and that was another key point in the history of mushing was the Great Sarum Race to Nome, or Run to Nome, with the antitoxin for the diphtheria epidemic. You know, it focused attention on these amazing dogs and mushers who could, you know, were the most sensible way to transport this life-saving serum 700 miles across the state of Alaska in the middle of winter. There was no other way to get it there in time, but these dogs did it. And that kind of, you know, it brought an attention and a focus to Alaska and the sled dogs that really probably hadn't been there before. And then after the Sarum Run, not only Gunnar Cusson was the he ended up delivering the Sarum into Nome with Balto as his leader, but Leonard Sepulow actually owned Balto. There's a whole story behind that. Togo and Fritz were Sepulow's leaders. And Sepulow and Cusson both took Togo and Fritz and Balto, and they all went on these tours around the U.S. and, you know, just, you know, ended up, I believe they ended up back seeing the president and such. You know, they ended up with the statue of Balto in Central Park, and that, you know, it was kind of like a golden era for sled dog races. And,
right.
And you know, I think that had a lot to do with shaping how things happened.
You know, a lot of folks that are involved in mushing, whether it be, you know, the backyard musher that has two or three dogs, you know, that runs around on the trails and possibly a little sprint race on the weekend, to, you know, to the big mega teams that are planning to run the Iditarod. A lot of folks still has a very romantic perception of mushing. Throughout your studies and your research, can you tell us a little bit outside of that? You know, so many people think, oh, I would just love, I hear this all the time, I would just love to be out there on a dog sled and do what you do every day. Can you tell us a little bit maybe about, you know, the day-to-day back in the history compared to what everybody thinks it is today?
Well, I'm not 100% certain how you mean that question, but I'll give it a shot. Are you talking about the care of the dogs?
No, let's talk about, instead of, I guess what I'm trying to say, instead of making it a glamorous thing, like, oh my goodness, you're a musher type thing. You always hear that. Tell us a little bit about what you have read and understood the life of a musher back then, you know, in the early 1900s. You know, today it's, you know, we have our fancy fur parkas and all these cute little puppies running around, and we're doing speaking engagements and that sort of stuff as sports figures. You know what I'm saying?
Compared
to the daily life of some of these guys way back in the early days of the sport.
Okay, I think I see where you're going then. Well, for one thing, I don't think it was considered so much a glamour sport back then in the sense it is now as a mode of transportation to get stuff done that just, you know, that goods needed to be moved to the mine, people needed to be moved here and there. You know, dogs and the dog teams were used for transport. They carried passengers on the trails. They hauled freight across the trails. They hauled the U.S. mail for years, I mean, up until 1963 when the last U.S. mail team was retired. They hauled mail. They patrolled out of some of the northern army posts. The missionaries used their dog teams. I mean, these were working animals, and almost in the same sense that we think of our cars and trucks today. This was just a mode of transportation, get on down the trail, and I don't think there was really a glamorous aspect to it. Now, there was a bit of glamour involved with, you know, writers like... one that comes to mind is Esther Birdsell Darling. She did a lot to glamorize the sport of mushing. Barrett Willoughby was another one. She wrote, you know, The Trail Eater, which is about the All-Alaska Sweepstakes, and, you know, the mushers were just these incredible figures with these amazing dogs who could, you know, just run for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, there was a bit of that, and, of course, after the Sarum Run, the dogs and the mushers were heroes. But, you know, historically... they were just a mode of transportation. They were just a way to get from one place to another. And, you know, while the amazing dogs came along from time to time, as a general rule, they were just, you know, working animals.
Right. So you mentioned Leonard Seppala and Scotty Allen and of course, the Sarum Run. And there's a heck of a lot of history between, you know, 1908, you know, the early 20s up until the Sarum Run in 25. You mentioned that there was a story there. Can you share that with us between the lead dogs?
okay, that would be the story. Everyone's familiar with Balto, the heroic dog who saved... you know, saved Nome by carrying the serum. Well, Leonard Seppala's dog Togo was actually the one who went the farthest. I can't remember the mileage. It's pretty easy to look up. But Togo was the real hero of the Sarum Run, and he's the dog that you see in the Iditarod, the Iditarod headquarters today. He's in one of the glass cases, and a lot of people look at him, and unless you go up and read the little placard next to him, you know, really, he doesn't look like much of a dog, but he really was a stout-hearted little guy, and he did the longest distance over the roughest stretch, and he was Leonard Seppala's hero. I mean, that was his favorite lead dog. That was the one that he took everywhere with him. I've got a poster on my wall right now, in fact. It's an ad for a brewing company, and it's for a Balto lager beer. And it shows a picture of Leonard Seppala with his husky on his shoulder, who's supposedly Balto. Well, it's not. It's actually Togo. And I just love it because it, you know, kind of exemplifies the situation between the two. Balto became the hero because he was the one who happened to be on Front Street with the serum when the photographers were there. But Togo was the one who actually, you know, saved the day and made the longest run when, you know, another dog probably couldn't have done what he did.
And you mentioned that you can find out more about that. I know that you have written several books about mushing, and you're coming out with a brand new one, Along the Alaskan Trails, and that's going to be released in July.
Right.
Did you cover a lot of that pre-Sarum Run history? And pardon me, I haven't read any of your works yet, but have you covered any of that pre-Sarum Run history in any of your writings?
Yes, absolutely. That's the focus of Along Alaskan Trails is... primarily what happened before, you know, mushing became what it is today.
Right, right. So out of all of these characters that you studied for your book, who has become the standout favorite, at least in your mind?
Oh, that's easy. That's Yujiro Wada.
Let's talk about, and I'm not familiar with that name, so let's talk about him or her.
Okay, Jairo, his name is spelled J-U-J-I-R-O. His last name is Wada, W-A-D-A. He was Japanese. He was born, I believe, sometime in the 1870s. He was born around 1870s. He came to the U.S. and worked with Charlie Brower up at Barrow. He was with E.T. Barnett when he landed at what is now the site of Fairbanks. He was a cabin boy on one of the ships that cruised around the northern waters back then. Jairo Wada and his dog team became fairly well-known in Alaska at the time because he was everywhere. He traveled the trails. He was in Fairbanks. He was in Dawson City. He was in Nome. He was in Iditarod. He was in Seward. He was everywhere. There's another great book by Hudson Stuck, who was an Episcopalian missionary, and he wrote this book called 10,000 Miles with a Dog Sled, which a lot of people are familiar with. Well, I'm sure Jairo Wada must have gone far more than 10,000 miles if you look at his travels. There was a book written about him in the 90s called The Samurai Dog Musher Under the Northern Lights. And he was in, I don't remember the year, but the city of Seward, when gold was found in Iditarod, they hired Jairo Wada to see if an overland trail, which eventually became the Iditarod Trail, could be opened up between Seward and Iditarod. So it was Jairo, and I forget how many other, there were a couple other guys went with him, but he was the leader of the team. They basically blazed the trail and said, yes, we can get to Iditarod from here, and that was kind of the beginning and the opening of the Iditarod. I mean, it had been a trail traditionally, or a series of trails, and he kind of knitted them together and said, yes, there is a way to get to Iditarod where the gold is from here, and that became the Iditarod Trail.
So, and a lot of people don't know that, but the original trail starts down there near Seward. I believe
that's
there's
right.
some mile markers down there. I know there's one here in Palmer where we're hosting our show. That this used to be a stop as well, wasn't it?
No, the trail never went through Palmer.
Okay.
Unfortunately,
I just saw something at the state fairgrounds or something that said, you know, I did a trail marker or something. Maybe it was just a decoration piece.
May have been one they moved, but the original trail, I don't believe, went through there.
So when those guys were running on those trails from Seward, you know, up through, and this is way back in the day. This was before a heck of a lot of people were in the Anchorage area and whatnot. How difficult was it for those guys to travel up that, you know, through the Matsu Valley and whatnot up towards present day Iditarod?
Well, I think there were some fairly established trails. I mean, people had been traveling the country for many decades before the white men came along with their dog teams. You know, the natives had traveled, so those trails were there. There were game trails. There were hunting trails. And I think basically what the mushers did was stitch those trails together into longer routes.
Right. And we mentioned, we've had a guest on as well that talked about the mail carriers and the freight carriers and that sort of thing. It was a tough life, wasn't it?
It was. They didn't have the kind of protective gear that we have these days. They didn't have the technology. They relied on old ways, which in their way were adequate, were sufficient, but they weren't nearly as comfortable as mushers are these days.
You know, we were talking to Mitch Seavey last week on the show, and he was talking about maybe we should go back to that, at least on that Iditarod, and make, you know, he was talking about his dad, Dan, about he would like to have a rule somewhere that says that we have to wear fur instead of all these fancy Gore-Tex and all that sort of stuff.
Well, Dan would do that quite easily, but I'm not sure about some of these younger mushers.
so as we are talking about mushing history here, you know, we're building up towards the Serum Run and, you know, early mushing history, at least in terms of Alaska. Of course, there's a heck of a lot of mushing going on in Siberia and whatnot, you know, back and forth, the seal hunters and all that sort of stuff way back in the day. But as we're building up to this, a lot of people know about the Serum Run and why it happened and, you know, how it began and that sort of thing and the reason behind it. But can you educate our listeners a little bit about the guys that ran the relay? How were those guys picked? Do you know?
No, I don't. That's covered pretty thoroughly in the book The Cruelest Miles by Gay and Lainey Salisbury.
Okay.
They wrote the book on the Sarum Run, and, you know, while I know I've read it, I couldn't say I could authoritatively answer that question, Robert.
And a lot of those guys, as we mentioned, they were the freight haulers and the mail carriers.
Yes, they were.
Back
yeah,
and
were.
Forth. Yep. And a lot of folks think about the Sarum Run, they equate it to the Iditarod. They think a lot of these guys ran the full route, you know, from Nenana to Nome, you know, 800 and some odd miles. They didn't. It was some of them had very short sections of the trail that they ran, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah, I think one guy ran like only 30 or 40 miles. It was a relay race. They handed it off to each other from, you know, they would run up to a point and then hand it off to the next guy and, you know, just basically bounced it from musher to musher, 800 miles from Nenana to Nome.
And you know,
that's another misunderstanding that a lot of people have is they think, oh, it must have started in Anchorage. Well, no, it started in Nenana, which is, you know, about 250 miles north of Anchorage.
Right, and what I was going to mention there, and you said it right there, is they do the commemorative run every couple of years, the Sarum Run from Nenana to Nome, and it's going to take place next February, and they follow the route and do all sorts of stuff, and that's another show altogether, and I'm sure we could talk about that. And I know you were up for the last one, taking pictures and interviews and that sort of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's commemorated today? You know, a lot of people misunderstand. They think the Iditarod was the Sarum Run, and it's not.
No, not really. A lot of people think that the Iditarod was patterned after the Sarum Run, but it's, you know, it really was. Well, that would be talking about a different subject, Joe Reddington. But back to the Sarum Run. The Sarum Run was... Okay, I lost a train of thought. What question were you looking for?
We were talking about how people always pattern the present day Iditarod. And of course, it runs on some of the of that route, but it's not. It's a race compared to the Sarum Run, which was, you know, a mission, I guess.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit. We have about 8 minutes left, and I'm sure we're bouncing around a little bit, and we could talk for hours about each one of these subjects. But I'm trying to get us up at least today to about the 60s, and I hope to have Helen back on in a few weeks so we can cover up the next section of mushing history. Helen, could you talk a little bit about what happened between, let's say, 1925 to up to the 60s? What was happening in mushing as a sport, as a mode of transportation? Of course, the snow machine came in into play at that time, of airplanes, that sort of thing. What can you share about the next 20 years or so?
Right, that's exactly what happened, and that was the reason behind the founding of the Iditarod. After mushing became, you know, basically the primary mode of transportation, and around the turn of the century and up through the 20s, and I think probably right even up through the 30s, then, you know, the airplane was probably the first thing that started replacing the sled dogs. It wasn't until the 1960s that the last mail contract ran from, I believe it was from Gamble to Savunga. And, you know, they retired the dog sleds as a way of transferring the mail. But they had also discovered that, you know, airplanes could move mail or move goods and freight and people and things faster and more efficiently and, you know, perhaps cheaper, I'm not sure, but, you know, definitely faster. You know, cars, snow machines became so popular that Joe Reddington was afraid they were going to totally replace the Huskies and that, you know, sled dogs wouldn't be anymore. And interestingly, if I can back up a little bit, that wasn't the first time that Huskies were in danger of being replaced. There was a chapter of my book is called The Huskies and the Reindeer, and it's about, let me think when that was. I believe it was in the 1930s. I can't remember his name right now, but Sheldon was his name. He kind of he started campaigning for reindeer to be the mode of transportation, and he made a fairly effective argument that reindeer were easier to keep because they would feed on lichen, didn't need to be fed like sled dogs did. He thought they were gentler, kinder animals, not prone to fighting like sled dogs. He had a whole laundry list of reasons why reindeer should be used in place of sled dogs. And he got far enough with his ideas that there was really, he got a lot of the U.S. mail, especially up around Nome and in far western Alaska, those were carried by reindeer teams instead of sled dog teams. And the reindeer, you could eat reindeer. People weren't too fond of eating sled dogs, so there was another purpose and reason behind switching to them. The missionary Hudson Stuck became his primary opponent because he said, no, there's no way the reindeer's ever going to replace the sled dog. So they kind of went back and forth about this for quite a while. And it's a real interesting chapter of Alaskan history that not too many people are familiar with. That was about the same time that the Lohman brothers, Carl Lohman, was called the Reindeer King, and there was an Eskimo woman called Senroc Mary who had a reindeer herd. I'm talking thousands of reindeer. They had these gigantic herds. In fact, they had such huge herds that they basically decimated a lot of western Alaska, and the herd started dying off because they'd eaten everything there was to eat.
Wow.
So it's a whole really, really interesting part of Alaskan history, which, directly, again, relates to the sled dogs.
And what year was that, Helen, when this controversy or this back and forth was going on between those guys?
Oh, well.
30s then?
I believe it was around the 30s.
I didn't know that part of history. That's pretty interesting. Again, another reason to go out and get Helen's book. It's not going to be published until sometime in July. Is that right?
It should be available July 1st.
Oh, very cool. And we're going to put up a link on our website for that so they can pre-order and order after the show is over. They can listen to this all the time. So, Helen, we have just a couple of minutes left. I definitely want to have you back on if you're game. We can talk for hours about this.
Certainly.
One final bit there. I guess we've made it to the 30s. What else do you want to mention up to this point in the mushing history?
Oh, boy, there's so much. There was a lot of history that people don't know about. It's like a dog team Slim Williams took over what is now the Alaska Highway. He traveled down to Chicago, Illinois for an exposition down there, and he was proving that you could get from Alaska to the lower 48. He basically blazed a route, and which later became the Alaska Highway. Another lady, Mary Joyce, took her dog team from Juneau to Fairbanks, and she wasn't trying to prove anything. She was just trying to get to Fairbanks. But, these people were traveling those routes back then when people didn't think it could be done.
Wow, that's cool stuff. Was that the guy that made it to Chicago? We have about a minute left, so we have to keep this short. Was that the guy that made it to Chicago? And at times he had wheels on the sleds and that
right.
sort of thing.
Yes, that is. He had this ingenious set of wheels for his sled. They were off a Model T Ford or something, wooden wheels. And I've got a picture of that in my book. It's really quite a fantastic image.
Very cool. Helen, tell us some websites and how to contact you.
My website's easy. It's northernlightmedia.com, all one word.
Very cool. And there's contact information, phone numbers, how to order your book and whatnot from there. Helen Hegener, I believe I'm saying that correctly. Apologize if I'm not. We definitely will have you back on in a few weeks. We have a heck of a lot of history we could talk about, and the microphone's open anytime.
Great. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much. Next week, we will not have a live show here on Mushing Radio. We're going to do just a recording from one of the guys that we've already spoke to, possibly Martin Booser, maybe Mitch Seavey again, possibly the Iditarod champ Dallas Seavey. We don't know who's going to be on yet, but stay tuned to Mushing Radio here on KVRF. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.